Welcome to the Alabama Forest Owners Association live teleconference. We're joined by 10 insightful panelists. Audience, you can hear the conversation, and at the end, you'll be invited to help critique this session. Our goal is to provide you with the latest information on forestry. You can see an image of the speakers if you have a computer and can access the Alabama Forest Owners Association website, alabamaforestowners.com, by clicking on the teleconference icon on the homepage. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll serve as moderator of today's discussion. We're joined by Jane Shaw, a senior associate of the Political Economy Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. Jane has co-authored a fantastic new book that's recently been published entitled Facts, Not Fear. Jane, the title of this book suggests that there's some misinformation about forestry. What do children learn about forestry in Alabama schools today?
Well, Hayes, I'm afraid it's not a very encouraging story. Generally, on the positive side, children learn that planting trees is good, but cutting them down is bad. And you may have heard the story of the little girl who was very sad when she had received a new bed from an aunt, a relative of hers. It was made out of wood, and her mother noticed that she was feeling a little sad, and she said, "Well, you know, I love my bed, my new bed, but they killed trees to make my bed." And this is the image that children get, that we have a very fragile nature that must be protected at all costs, and the tree should not be logged.
Do you find that teachers bring certain assumptions to the classroom about either scientific method or maybe even economic principles?
I think that there's a real problem. Teachers themselves will tell you that they are not trained as well as they would like to be in sciences.
Your book, Facts Not Fear, can be accessed, some more information on the Alabama Forest Owners Association website, by clicking the icon next to your image. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you very much.
Also at our round table is Kiva Larson with Larson and McGowan Forestry Consultants. Larson has some information about the implication dealing with the repeal of the death tax. Evil, we've recently read where both the House and the Senate passed a gradual repeal of the death tax, and this bill will be presented to the President, who's promised to veto it. Many people believe that even if the bill is passed, there will be no tax on assets that pass through an estate. Is this true?
No, there will be some tax, but it's going to be, the good news is it's much less and it'll come at a better time. Inherited land and timber will retain the basis of the original owner. That is, there's not a stepped-up basis. And when there's a sale, tax will be paid on the gain. But the real advantage, of course, is paying a 20% tax at the time the owner chooses, rather than 37 to 55% at an unpredictable time.
Okay, so it sounds like although there will not be a stepped-up basis and there will be some tax to pay, it'll be at a lower rate.
Yes.
Okay, the lower rate applicable to a capital gain sale rather than the higher rate, which would apply if the current law stays in effect at the time of death.
That's correct. It's a real improvement once it's needed so long.
What should landowners do now if they wish to make their views known about the death tax?
Well, the group that's worked so hard, and it's really been a very dedicated and broad-based group across the country to get us to this point, asked the leadership of both the House and the Senate to delay sending this to the President, who has said he'll veto it, and they've asked him to delay it until the end of August to give a chance for everybody to tell the President how we feel about it. And there's three ways you can do it: fax, email, and telephone. Those numbers will be on a website. The best place to get some good information on this is the Forest Landowners Tax Council website, which is fltc.org. And that website has a sample letter, email address for the President, which is simply president@whitehouse.gov, and telephone and fax numbers.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kiva. We appreciate that breaking news on the death tax. Well, from death to taxes, we move to another subject, replanting and regeneration of forest. And we're joined by Dr. Ken McNabb of the Auburn University School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences.
Good morning. Good
morning, Dr. McNabb. Planting season's not until the end of the year, but what should forest landowners be doing now to make sure that they have seedlings when planting time comes?
Well, the first thing they need to be doing is finding a nursery and talking to a nursery manager and ordering some seedlings, particularly if they're interested in longleaf pine. Now, if they're going to plant longleaf pine, the seedling supplies are pretty short. So they need to get their order in very quickly if they haven't done so already. Now, lob and slash, the availability is a little bit looser, and they should be able to find seedlings. But they still need to get them on order and need to be calling up the nursery managers.
Well, how could the landowner find a list of tree planting firms who can do this service for them? Is there any way that such a list can be made available?
County agents should have a list of those seedlings. I put together a list here earlier this year of nurseries in the state and the species that they sell, as well as the general price range of those seedlings, and I can certainly get it to them if anybody wants to contact me at Auburn University. I'd be willing to send it to them. But the county agents also have copies of this publication and should be able to get it to them.
Okay. Dr. McNabb, I'd recently heard where there's been $200,000 made available to replant trees that have been killed either by the pine beetle or by drought, and that money's available at the NCRS office. Are you familiar with any releasing of money to replant trees and that are affected by that condition?
I'm sorry, that's news to me. I have to check on that myself. I'm sure there's some kind of a process that it involves verifying the damage and filling out some papers and so forth. But
that's right.
Sorry, I'm not familiar with it.
Well, we had learned that it was available through the NCRS office, which is, as you suggested, the local county office. So landowners could perhaps inquire at that venue. Thank you, Dr. McNabb, for joining us.
Very good. Thank you.
Also at the Forestry Roundtable, we're joined by Kevin McKinstry with Westervelt Wildlife Services. Kevin is a certified wildlife biologist and specializes in quality deer management. Kevin, forest owners are always looking for ways to enhance the value of their land for hunting purposes. Is there anything a landowner can do to increase what he knows about the deer herd on his land?
Yes, sir. We find the hunting league customers today are much more educated than they were, say, 10 years ago. And we're showing somebody a hunting lease. Of course, they want to know how much it'll cost, but secondly, they do have some questions on the deer quality on the property. And infrared triggered cameras can be used to capture photographs of mature bucks that live on your land, and to conduct a true deer census with these cameras would be fairly expensive, but just to use these cameras to take photographs is relatively cheap. They can be set over bait sites and will operate 24 hours a day that will allow them to capture images of mature bucks that we don't normally see during daylight hours. And of course, the photographs can be compiled as a portfolio of mature bucks that exist on your property to show to your either your current lease customers or any prospective customers to kind of show them the deer quality you have on your property. Prospective lease customers are willing to pay more if they see that a 4 or 5 year intensive deer management program wouldn't be necessary to produce high quality bucks on your land, and if they can just step in and continue the current quality deer management approach, then that makes your lease much more attractive and more valuable.
Well, this certainly sounds like a high-tech approach to hunting and identifying the herd that's on your property. How do these cameras work and how are they attached?
They're pretty much a self-contained unit. There's the technology has really evolved over the last 10 years, and of course the price has also become more reasonable. But they house an infrared trigger device that emits a beam, and when the beam you place the beam and camera over a bait site or a trail or a scrape, someplace that deer are going to travel. And when they break that beam, the camera, you know, captures the image, and they operate. It's a self-contained unit, weatherproof camera, and we normally attach them to a tree or a post, whatever's available.
You have an idea of what a camera like that would cost and how many you would need to attach in a per-acre site to have a good idea of of what your deer herd is?
Right. The units are pretty much, you can pretty much pick up a nice unit for $250 to $300 for a passive system. That's about half of what they cost, say, about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you would just, if you wanted to do a complete deer census over your property, the technique requires about a density, camera density of about one camera per 130 acres. That's pretty intensive, and that would be a fairly expensive process. But just to capture, just try to get some photographs of the kind of deer you have and on your land, things like that, you know, you can get away with, you know, two to three cameras.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us, Kevin McKinstry. Next, we have joining with us Jim Jeter with the Alabama Forestry Commission. He's with us today, and he's been involved in organizing pine beetle detection and suppression activities in northwest Alabama for landowners. Jim, we've been hearing a lot about the situation with the pine beetles. How does it look like from your perspective?
Well, the epidemic is increasing. We have 17 counties in our northwest region. All 17 are going to be categorized as epidemic proportions this time, and what we're seeing from our June to July flights is the number of spots are quadrupling, and the number of trees infesting are 7 and 8 times the number, and it really alarms us that we're seeing these types of numbers this early in the summer. Normally those are the type of numbers toward the end of the summer. Here we are at the end of July, and we've got, you know, a major epidemic situation going and still got 2 or 3, 4 months of drought left to go. And that seems to be the main factor involved is the drought and the moisture content in the upper 3 to 5 feet of the soil.
Has this been extensive? I know you're working primarily in northwest Alabama, but is this the situation generally around the state?
Well, I'd say the upper four-fifths of the state, and this year we're actually seeing some long leaves affected due to the drought situation and the inavailability of moisture in the tree to resin out the bugs themselves, so we're actually seeing some longleaf pines affected this time. But I would say other than the lower coastal plain and the lower coastal states, from the middle two-thirds of the state up, it's getting critical.
Mm-hmm. What do you think a forest landowner should do if he finds a beetle spot? What is the first thing he should do in trying to control it, minimize it, or do something with it?
Well, the first thing he ought to do is obviously we're overloaded with our work, and our detection system is running 3 to 4 weeks behind, and what we're finding is these bugs are moving quite rapidly through plantation situations, especially CRP situations. So the first thing I do is exactly what you said, advise the landowner to do some checking on his own. If he finds a spot that he suspects it's southern pine beetle, I would get a forester or somebody that is knowledgeable about the insect to verify what they found and then take control measures from there, either a cut and leave situation or a salvage situation.
Okay. Thank you, Jim, for that report on the pine beetle infestation and the drought. And as we discuss the drought and pine beetles, it's always good to consider how this issue can be dealt with on your annual tax return. And we're joined today by Henry Barclay, CPA at Lehman, Ullman & Barclay in Birmingham, Alabama, who's an expert on timber tax issues and also is the current president of the Alabama Forest Owners Association. Henry, we're hearing about drought conditions all around the state. I understand the state's been declared, 67 counties in the state have been declared as state disaster areas. What do you see as the tax implications for forest landowners under this condition?
Hey, that's a great question. Let's just, for purposes of illustration, assume that we're talking about property that people have held over a year, so it's a long-term property. Droughts lead to pine beetle infestations, as we've heard, fire, storm damage. And IRS takes a position that insect damage and drought damage is not sudden enough to qualify as a so-called casualty loss, but fire and storm damage would be sudden enough to qualify as a casualty loss. Timberland owners in the trade or business who have net casualty losses will generally report those losses as ordinary deductions. So if there's some bad news, that's some good news. However, those same owners with non-casualty losses will have to include the losses with other business gains and losses to determine whether they're going to get an ordinary deduction or just a deduction against their capital gains. Obviously, a straight ordinary deduction would be the best answer. Now, timberland owners who are investors get an ordinary deduction for their casualty losses. However, they'll have to combine non-casualty losses with other business gains to determine whether they're going to get an ordinary deduction or just a deduction against capital gains. And again, that straight ordinary deduction is better. The courts seem to support pine beetle infestation losses as casualties, but be prepared to litigate this issue. Otherwise, treat beetle damage just as a non-casualty loss and treat it accordingly. Some timber owners can actually have gains, or what's called casualty gains, from selling damaged timber. The law allows for a deferral of that gain if you invest in like-kind property within 2 or 3 years.
Henry, if landowners are interested in this topic and need to know some more details, do you have any information coming out in any of the upcoming newsletters?
There'll be some information in upcoming newsletters, and we're also going to put an online article covering this subject next week.
Okay. How can they access the online article? Would that be through the Alabama Forest Owners Association or through yours?
It'll be posted at lub.com.
Okay. Thank you, Henry. I appreciate that.
You bet.
Well, the concern over pine beetles has spread to Winston County in northwest Alabama, where opponents of designating the Bankhead National Forest as a national monument are organizing. We're joined by Myra Ball Bryant, who's a landowner and a leader of an organization known as the Alabama Forest Conservation and Multi-Users Association. Ms. Bryant's been a frequent voice of opposition to the national monument idea. Myra, you've recently returned from Washington, D.C. What did you learn at the nation's capital about this monument status in the Bankhead Forest?
Yes, we got back last night, and we met with congressmen and senators in our area, as well as some from other states. And basically everyone told us that there was little that they could do, but that they were opposed to the idea because it took the power away from the people. And just this designation can happen through the Antiquities Act. And all that has to happen is the president signed the proclamation, and it happens. So it takes away the power from the people or, you know, our representatives and gives it simply to the president to designate these areas.
Would you recommend, if people are interested in discussing the topic, that they discuss it directly with the office of the president, or would it be better to talk to their local congressman and senator?
Well, what we're encouraging right now, what we've been told we're doing right, is write letters to senators and representatives, as well as write letters to the White House, and contact Governor Siegelman. He apparently has more pull than they have in Washington with the president, and we really need him on our side.
All right. Well, thank you for that report from Washington. We appreciate your joining us today. We're also joined today at the roundtable by Mark Hines, who is a research coordinator for the Longleaf Alliance. Mark, what can you tell us about the activities of the Longleaf Alliance? I believe y'all are going to have a meeting in Louisiana soon.
Yes, sir. The Longleaf Alliance holds regional meetings once every 2 years. We held our first one in Mobile in 96. And we had about 200 people attending. We held our second one in Charleston in 98 with about 400 people attending. And our third regional conference will be held this October 16th through 18th in Alexandria, Louisiana, at the Holiday Inn and Riverfront Center.
All right.
It'll be a three-day conference. The first day will be registration starting at 7. From 8 to noon, we'll hold the general session with invited speakers presenting overviews of silviculture, ecological, social, political, and economic issues of longleaf pine. And that afternoon, we will hold concurrent sessions with speakers addressing regeneration, fire, ecology, and other issues of longleaf pine.
So that date, again, is October 16th through 18th.
That is correct.
In Alexandria, Louisiana.
Yes, and if foresters looking for Category 1, CFP points just qualifies for 13. And if the deadline for late registration is September 1st, is $275. After September 1st, is $25 less before. And then if you're a member of the Longleaf Alliance, it's a further reduction in fees. They can call us here at the Long Leaf Alliance at 334-222-7779 for more information on that conference.
All right, and I believe we have a link to you as well on the FOA homepage. Thank you for that report, Mark. We're next joined by Jessica Little. Forest landowners are always interested in what's going on in the timberland market. We've asked Jessica to join us. Jessica's with Larson and McGowan Forestry Consultants. Jessica, tell us how interested parties can get information on property for sale.
Okay, well, we are offering right now, we have a large tract of timberland in southwest Alabama. It's the property is within an hour's drive of Pensacola and Mobile. It's about 2,400 acres. It's being sold by large family ownership that's owned the property for about 40 years, and Larson McGowan has managed it for that time. It's being sold by a sealed bid in six different tracts. The property is not contiguous. Two of the tracts are in Baldwin County. Four of them are in Escambia County, Alabama. They range in size from 160 acres to 670 acres. They're primarily natural stands and primarily longleaf timber, and it's all the property is well stocked with timber.
Okay, so it looks like there's six tracts for sale in Baldwin and Escambia County, totaling 2,400 acres.
Right, and the bidders will have the option of either bidding on the entire property or bidding on individual tracts.
All right, that's normally how the sales occur.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Well, we have a link to you at Larson McGowan if someone is interested in inquiring further about that property for sale. Jessica,
okay.
We thank you for joining us.
Sure.
Our final guest, last but not least, is Dennis LeBlue. Dennis is with Marshall, is sitting in actually for Marshall Thomas at F&W Forestry Services. We appreciate your attending today. Dennis, our forest landowners always concerned and interested about the timber market. We've heard about some timber land for sale. Tell us about how the stumpage market is behaving these days.
Well, the short-term market is certainly in a downward spin at the moment. We've had a lot of dry weather, and droughts really affected the amount of wood getting into the mills. And we've had our annual closings for maintenance as well. That affect our prices, and the sawmills all carry a lower inventory this time of year as well. So all our short-term factors are pointing to a downward trend. Some of the other things that have affected us in the longer run is we've had a lot of consolidation of companies in the last couple of years in the industry, and that's affected the amount of competition we have out there. We've also had some closings of our pulp mills as well.
Looks like it's being affected both in the macro scale by the consolidation of companies and also with the weather.
That's exactly right. We've also done a lot better job of growing timber these days. We're producing more volume per acre, and we've put a lot of acres back into timberland that were in cropland. So we've increased our supply as well.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like we're a victim of our own success in a certain sense.
That's true.
Is this the case across the southeast, or is it unique or worse or better in any particular state or region?
I would say that our production of wood is probably unique to the southeast, that we've increased it this much. Mm-hmm. The consolidation of the markets is that's pretty much a worldwide factor there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dennis, I'll put you on the spot, and I know that you can't make any firm predictions about the future. No one can, but you might have a guess. Do you have a guess at all about what the future holds for us?
Well, I think pulpwood prices are going to remain stable for a while to come, and maybe even on the depressed side. Saw timber is very cyclical, going with the interest rates and housing, and also going with the changes in weather. So I feel like we'll have an increase in our saw timber prices over the winter months this year as the mills start to try to build some inventories for the wet time of year, and I believe pulpwood prices are going to remain stable or even on the depressed side.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it'll remain difficult for landowners who wish to sell timber who have a sizable component of pulpwood to achieve the highest price.
It really will, and that's really been a problem for us with the beetle situation, the way it is in the state of Alabama. It's been hard to get these places cut or get that wood moved.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we certainly appreciate your joining us, Dennis. We also extend our thanks to the remaining part of the panel. We appreciate your joining us and for helping us put together this live teleconference. We'd like to ask you to join us for a critique session in which our audience will be able to participate with a critique session on how we've performed this first attempt at a live teleconference with the breaking news of forestry in Alabama throughout the nation. This ends the live teleconference. We appreciate your attending, and we invite you to continue to attend for a critique session as the mute buttons are released and we're able to talk to one another. Thank you for attending.